Chapter 42. A lady friend recommended the application of a mustard plaster to my breast. I believe that would have cured me effectually, if it had not been for young Wilson. When I went to bed, I put my mustard plaster, which was a very gorgeous one, 18 inches square where I could reach it, when I was ready for it. But young Wilson got hungry in the night, and here is food for the imagination. After sojourning a week at Lake Bigler, I went to Steamboat Springs, and, besides the steam baths, I took a lot of the vilest medicines that were ever concocted. They would have cured me, but I had to go back to Virginia City, where, notwithstanding the variety of new remedies I absorbed every day, I managed to aggravate my disease by carelessness and undue exposure. I finally concluded to visit San Francisco, and the first day I got there a lady at the hotel told me to drink a quart of whiskey every 24 hours, and a friend uptown recommended precisely the same course. Each advised me to take a quart, that made half a gallon. I did it, and still live. Now, with the kindest motives in the world, I offer for the consideration of consumptive patients the variegated course of treatment I have lately gone through. Let them try it. If it don't cure, it can't more than kill them. A Curious Pleasure Excursion, published at the time of the Amit Scare in the summer of 1874, we have received the following advertisement. But, inasmuch as it concerns a matter of deep and general interest, we feel fully justified in inserting it in our reading columns. We are confident that our conduct in this regard needs only explanation, not apology. Ed. N. Y. Herald. Advertisement: this is to inform the public that in connection with Mr. Barnum I have leased the Comet for a term of years, and I desire also to solicit the public patronage in favor of a beneficial enterprise which we have in view. We propose to fit up comfortable, and even luxurious, accommodations in the Comet for as many persons as will honor us with their patronage, and make an extended excursion among the heavenly bodies. We shall prepare 1,000,000 staterooms in the tail of the Comet with hot and cold water, gas, looking glass, parachute, umbrella, etc., in each, and shall construct more, if we meet with a sufficiently generous encouragement. We shall have billiard rooms, card rooms, music rooms, bowling alleys and many spacious theaters and free libraries. And on the main deck we propose to have a driving park, with upward of 100,000 miles of roadway in it. We shall publish daily newspapers also. Departure of the Comet. The Comet will leave New York at 10 p.m. on the 20th inst. And therefore it will be desirable that the passengers be on board by 8 at the latest, to avoid confusion in getting underway. It is not known whether passports will be necessary or not, but it is deemed best that passengers provide them, and so guard against all contingencies. No dogs will be allowed on board. This rule has been made in deference to the existing state of feeling regarding these animals, and will be strictly adhered to. The safety of the passengers will in all ways be jealously looked to. A substantial iron railing will be put up all around the Comet, and no one will be allowed to go to the edge and look over, unless accompanied by either my partner or myself. The postal service will be of the completest character. Of course the telegraph, and the telegraph only, will be employed. Consequently friends occupying state dash rooms 20,000,000, and even 30 million miles apart will be able to send a message, and receive a reply inside of 11 days. Night messages will be half rate. The whole of this vast postal system will be under the personal superintendence of Mr. Hale of Maine. Meals served at all hours. Meals served in staterooms charged extra. Hostility is not apprehended from any great planet, but we have thought it best to err on the safe side, and therefore have provided a proper number of mortars, siege guns, and boarding pikes. History shows that small, isolated communities, such as the people of remote islands, are prone to be hostile to strangers, and so the same may be the case with the inhabitants of stars of the 10th or 20th magnitude. We shall in no case wantonly offend the people of any star, but shall treat all alike with urbanity and kindliness, never conducting ourselves toward an asteroid after a fashion which we could not venture to assume toward Jupiter or Saturn. I repeat that we shall not wantonly offend any star, but at the same time we shall promptly resent any injury that may be done us, or any insolence offered us, by parties or governments residing in any star in the firmament. Although averse to the shedding of blood, we shall still hold this course rigidly and fearlessly, not only toward single stars, but toward constellations. We shall hope to leave a good impression of America behind us in every nation we visit, from Venus to Uranus. And, at all events, if we cannot inspire love, we shall at least compel respect for our country wherever we go. We shall take with us, free of charge, a great force of missionaries, and shed the true light upon all the celestial orbs which, physically aglow, are yet morally in darkness. Sunday schools will be established wherever practicable. Compulsory education will also be introduced. The comet will visit Mars first, and proceed to Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturn. Parties connected with the government of the District of Columbia, and with the former city government of New York, who may desire to inspect the rings, will be allowed time and every facility. Every star of prominent magnitude will be visited, and time allowed for excursions to points of interest inland. The dog star has been stricken from the program. Much time will be spent in the Great Bear, and, indeed, in every constellation of importance. So, also, with the Sun and Moon and the Milky Way, otherwise the Gulf Stream of the skies. Clothing suitable for wherein the Sun should be provided. Our program has been so arranged that we shall seldom go more than 100,000 of miles at a time without stopping at some star. This will necessarily make the stoppages frequent and preserve the interest of the tourist. Baggage checked through to any point on the route. Parties desiring to make only a part of the proposed tour and thus save expense may stop over at any star they choose and wait for the return voyage. After visiting all the most celebrated stars and constellations in our system and personally inspecting the remotest sparks that even the most powerful telescope can now detect in the firmament, we shall proceed with good heart upon a stupendous voyage of discovery among the countless whirling worlds that make turmoil in the mighty wastes of space, that stretch their solemn solitudes, their unimaginable vastness billions upon billions of miles away beyond the farthest verge of telescopic vision, till by comparison the little sparkling vault we used to gaze at on Earth shall seem like a remembered phosphorescent flash of spangles which some tropical voyager's prow stirred into life for a single instant, and which 10,000 miles of phosphorescent seas and tedious laps of time had since diminished to an incident utterly trivial in his recollection. Children occupying seats at the first table will be charged full fare. First class fare, from the Earth to Uranus, including visits to the Sun and Moon, and all the principal planets on the route, will be charged at the low rate of $2 for every 50,000 miles of actual travel. A great reduction will be made, where parties wish to make the round trip. This comet is new, and in thorough repair, and is now on her first voyage. She is confessedly the fastest on the line. She makes 20,000 miles a day, with her present facilities. But, with a picked American crew and good weather, we are confident we can get 40,000 out of her. Still, we shall never push her to a dangerous speed, and we shall rigidly prohibit racing with other comets. Passengers desiring to diverge at any point or return will be transferred to other comets. We make close connections at all principal points with all reliable lines. Safety can be depended upon. It is not to be denied that the heavens are infested with old ramshackle comets that have not been inspected or overhauled in 10,000 years, and which ought long ago to have been destroyed, or turned into ale barges, but with these we have no connection whatever. Steerage passengers not allowed abaft the main hatch. Complimentary round-trip tickets have been tendered to General Butler, Mr. Shepherd, Mr. Richardson, and other eminent gentlemen, whose public services have entitled them to the rest and relaxation of a voyage of this kind. Parties desiring to make the round trip will have extra accommodation. The entire voyage will be completed, and the passengers landed in New York again on the 14th of December, 1991. This is, at least, 40 years quicker than any other comet can do it in. Nearly all the back pay members contemplate making the round trip with us in case their constituents will allow them a holiday. Every harmless amusement will be allowed on board, but no pools permitted on the run of the comet, no gambling of any kind. All fixed stars will be respected by us, but such stars as seem to need fixing we shall fix. If it makes trouble, we shall be sorry, but firm. Mr. Kaguya having leased his comet to us, she will no longer be called by his name, but by my partners. N. B. Passengers by paying double fare will be entitled to a share in all the new stars, suns, moons, comets, meteors, and magazines of thunder and lightning we may discover. Patent medicine people will take notice that we carry bulletin boards and a paintbrush along for use in the constellations, and are open to terms. Cremationists are reminded that we are going straight to some hot places and are open to terms. To other parties our enterprise is a pleasure excursion, but individually we mean business. We shall fly our comet for all it is worth. For further particulars, or for freighter passage, apply on board, or to my partner, but not to me, since I do not take charge of the comet until she is underway. It is necessary, at a time like this, that my mind should not be burdened with small business details. Mark Twain. Running for governor, written about 1870. A few months ago I was nominated for governor of the great state of New York, to run against Mr. John T. Smith and Mr. Blank J. Blank on an independent ticket. I somehow felt that I had one prominent advantage over these gentlemen, and that was good character. It was easy to see by the newspapers that if ever they had known what it was to bear a good name, that time had gone by. It was plain that in these latter years they had become familiar with all manner of shameful crimes. But at the very moment that I was exulting my advantage, and joying in it in secret, there was a muddy undercurrent of discomfort eiling the deeps of my happiness, and that was the having to hear my name bandied about in familiar connection with those of such people. I grew more and more disturbed. Finally I wrote my grandmother about it. Her answer came quick and sharp. She said, "You have never done one single thing in all your life to be ashamed of, not one. Look at the newspapers, look at them, and comprehend what sort of characters Messrs. Smith and Blank are, and then see if you are willing to lower yourself to their level and enter a public canvass with them." It was my very thought. I did not sleep a single moment that night. But, after all, I could not recede. I was fully committed, and must go on with the fight. As I was looking listlessly over the papers at breakfast I came across this paragraph, and I may truly say I never was so confounded before. Perjury. Perhaps, now that Mr. Mark Twain is before the people as a candidate for governor, he will condescend to explain how he came to be convicted of perjury by 34 witnesses in Wakawak, Cochin China, in 1863, the intent of which perjury being to rob a poor native widow and her helpless family of a meager plantain patch, their only stay and support in their bereavement and desolation. Mr. Twain owes it to himself, as well as to the great people whose suffrages he asks, to clear this matter up. Will he do it? I thought I should burst with amazement. Such a cruel, heartless charge. I never had seen Cochin China. I never had heard of Wakaak. I didn't know a plantain patch from a kangaroo. I did not know what to do. I was crazed and helpless. I let the day slip away without doing anything at all. The next morning the same paper at this, nothing more. Significant. Mr. Twain, it will be observed, is suggestively silent about the Cochin China perjury. Ma'am. During the rest of the campaign this paper never referred to me in any other way than as the infamous perjurer Twain. Next came the Gazette, with this. Wanted to know. Will the new candidate for governor deign to explain to certain of his fellow citizens who are suffering to vote for him? The little circumstance of his cabin mates in Montana losing small valuables from time to time, until at last, these things having been invariably found on Mr. Twain's person, or in his drunk newspaper he rolled his traps in, they felt compelled to give him a friendly admonition for his own good, and so tarred and feathered him, and rode him on a rail, and then advised him to leave a permanent vacuum in the place he usually occupied in the camp. Will he do this? Could anything be more deliberately malicious than that? For I never was in Montana in my life. After this, this journal customarily spoke of me as Twain, the Montana thief. I got to picking up papers apprehensively, much as one would lift a desired blanket which he had some idea might have a rattlesnake under it. One day this met my eye. The lie nailed. By the sworn affidavits of Michael O'Flanagan Esquire, of the Five Points, and Mr. Snub Rafferty and Mr. Caddy Mulligan, of Water Street, it is established that Mr. Mark Twain's vile statement that the lamented grandfather of our noble standard- Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.